After I killed them, I walked home to await instructions. Get to Bruges.
Bruges. Bruges.
Bruges. Where's that?
It's in Belgium.
For 2 weeks, in Bruges, in a room like this, with you? No way.
Been to the top of the tower? Guidebook says it's a must-see.
Well, you ain't going up there.
Why?
It's all windy stairs. I'm not being funny.
What exactly are you trying to say?
There are a bunch of elephants.
Mr. Blakely?
Yes?
You have a message.
Number one, why aren't you in when I told you to be in? You better be in when I call again, or there'll be now to pay. I'm telling you.
He swears a lot, doesn't he?
You're listening to Because You Watched with Charlie and Francesco. I'm Charlie.
And I'm Francesco.
This is a podcast where we take a film that enjoyed significant mainstream success and use them as a starting point to discuss lesser-known films that we think deserve to spend 2 weeks in a small hotel room in the middle of Belgium.
Bruges is lovely. I would love to spend 2-3 weeks there and then get murdered.
Have you been to Bruges?
No, I want to go.
Have you been to Bruges?
I've not been to Bruges. I've been to Ypres twice, but never Bruges.
I've been to Ypres. Oh, I went to...
I tell a lie. I took a coach stop in Bruges on my way to Ypres.
Sorry, who are you?
Oh, hello.
We'll get to that later.
Ignore me.
I went to Bruges last year.
Okay.
I went on a holiday to Brussels with our Tom Skerritt correspondent, Will Smith, and we had a day trip and went to Bruges. And it was lovely, and every bit as pretty as you might hope. I don't think I could spend 2 weeks there.
See the swans?
Yeah, of course I saw the swans.
And the cobbled streets?
Yeah.
And the bridges?
Yeah.
And all the canals and that?
Yeah, and the park with the alcoves.
Alcoves.
Joining us today is former male model Fionn Krieber.
Thank you. Current educator and poet, Fionn Krieber. Nice to be here. Long time listener, first time speaker on microphone for podcast that is this podcast. And recent murderer of Paul Mescal, who could not be here today on account of being dead.
Care to give some backstory on
The only reason I said that is because Charlie, as I said, I do listen to this show because I think that Charlie, a friend that I've had for many years and someone...
Well, someone you've known for many years.
A friend for many years, Charlie. I would count you as a friend for many years. And I also enjoy listening to the two of you talk about films. And I listened to your After Sun podcast and Charlie said, oh, we should get Paul Mescal on here instead of Fionn. And I took umbrage at that and... You know.
So tell us about your new podcast with Paul Mescal.
My new podcast with Paul Mescal is really interesting, actually, because it's just me and him talking about how we're both born in 1996. We both reckon we could look pretty good in a mullet, and how I killed him to be here today.
Sounds like a pretty one-sided podcast.
It is mostly just me talking in the basement of my neighbor's house.
As Paul Mescal's corpse
slowly deteriorates. Yeah. Luckily, it's very cold, so it's being maintained.
Oh, that's nice.
It is nice. Yeah.
It's also where you keep the ice creams.
Yes. Yes, it's where I keep the ice creams.
All right, so today's film is Martin McDonagh's debut feature, 2008's In Bruges. Ray and Ken, two hitmen, are in Bruges, Belgium, waiting for their next mission. While they're there, they have time to think and discuss their previous assignment. When the mission is revealed to Ken, it is not what he expected.
What is it?
Pardon?
What did he expect?
Kill Paul Mescal.
He said he has to kill Colin Farrell.
It's unfortunate that Paul Mescal was only 12 when this film came out, and thus, if he had been killed, he would have to shoot himself in line with the principles of the movie.
But this is not a Paul Mescal podcast.
This is not a Paul Mescal podcast. There's that will be released soon.
There's not going to be any more Best Actor nominees by the end of this.
They're all dead. We're going to accidentally commission hits.
So we're recording this on the Friday before the Oscars.
But it will come out a few weeks after.
So what happened, we don't know.
That's when the smell gives it away.
Why wasn't he at the Oscars? Fionn, I know you have a lot to say about In Bruges.
I do.
But I want to just start with Francesco. As someone who has been into film for a very long time, but wasn't brought up in the UK, what was your first exposure to this film like?
That was a number of years ago. This was actually my third time watching it for the podcast. So it was a few years ago, came highly recommended, so it was really fun. Then I think I watched it again because it's just one of those films that's just easy to put on and watch in company. And I watched it again for the podcast. Just thought it was really funny. I'll say this. I didn't really know any of the actors apart from Colin Farrell. I'd seen the Harry Potter films as a kid. Didn't recognize Ray Fiennes due to the significant presence of a face and nose to him. And didn't remember Brendan Gleeson being in Harry Potter because I was never that big a fan of Harry Potter to remember all the actors in it.
And you didn't remember Clemens Posey either.
No, who's also in that same movie.
I remember Clemens Posey, kind of, yeah. But I think because I'd seen her in a TV show that came out around the same time that I watched in Bruges. But yeah, she was the only other actor that I recognized.
She is so beautiful in this movie.
Well, Clemens Posey is beautiful all of the time.
I agree. But I think, like, in the Harry Potter movie that she's in, or she's in two, but the one that she's primarily in, her whole deal is, like, being the perfect
child.
Which, you know, that's not weird finding her attractive when I saw that movie. A kid.
We were children.
Whereas this is like, it's like what Fionn was saying actually off mic, is that Colin Farrell is hot in a way that he is like the hottest person at a bar you could conceivably go to.
Mm.
I think Clemens Posey in this film
is the same.
Yeah, she has the same sort of hotness.
Yeah.
We can get on to Clemens Posey later. It's a bit car before the horse, but I just want to say, I really like her.
I think she's fantastic in this movie. I rewatched the film today. I've seen it probably like four times. It's a film made by someone who is ostensibly an Irish writer and director. So in my house, that is, you know, something that we take very seriously.
There are very few canonically great Irish films, so I do feel like you kind of have to take what you get. Whereas I feel like if you're talking about Jewish films, you have a bit more scope.
Yeah, there's something about that. It's like, I mean, one of the other picks I was thinking of today, I was saying to Shelley months ago, was The Quiet Man, which is a film with John Wayne, which actually, you know, I don't actually want to talk about John Wayne, but like I was saying, there's very sort of like few mainstream, like big Irish films that come out. And I think that this one, one thing that I really enjoyed about this film and was getting more on a rewatch is the sort of the phenomena of the Irish person who has lived in England for a long time, and how all of the jokes are about places in England rather than places in Ireland. Like, they make a joke about Tottenham, and they make a joke about Coventry and Croydon. The only time they mention Dublin is positively. It's like, I was born in Dublin, I think Dublin's great, unlike Bruges, which is a shithole.
And not to make this about Banshees of Inisherin, but I think it's notable, in Bruges wasn't written for two Irish actors.
No.
I think it was written to be more of like a Pinter-esque Cockney gangster thing. And I think that if you compare that to Banshees of Inisherin, and yes, that's set in a very different period and the characters very much aren't from Dublin, but there is a very specific Irishness to their dialogue which sounds more in common with Martin McDonagh's earlier plays.
Yeah.
As opposed to this, which is not, it doesn't sound wrong, but it's not as hyper-specific as that film.
It's not as idiosyncratic in the way that they are talking. And even The Guard, which we will talk about later, is more emphatically like located within Ireland. Like, you know, it's the west of Ireland, it's the Gaelic-speaking part of Ireland, so that sort of part of the culture comes through so much more clearly. Same thing, it's set in the same place as Banshees of Inisherin, which we are not talking about today.
I mean, let's not get bogged down in it yet.
Yeah.
Very good film.
Very good film. Also a movie about the boys.
It's a movie about the boys, which, again, we will definitely get onto in a sec. I feel like we're talking a bit over Francesco, but I do just have one thing just want to clarify, is that Fionn Creeber, people can probably tell you have some Irish heritage.
Yes.
But like Martin McDonagh, you were brought up in England.
Yes. I think I'm more English than Martin McDonagh is. I think both Martin McDonagh's parents are Irish and moved over when he moved over when he was a boy. I was born here. And it's just my mum who came over from Ireland. But yeah, I spent a lot of time in Ireland, have a lot of Irish family, sort of. I'm a token. I grew up in a place that is filled with people who came over from Ireland in the last 50 years. So when I was growing up, being half Irish, three quarters Irish, whatever, was the most common thing in the world. And then when I went to university, I suddenly became, Fionn, the Irish guy. And I was like, well, I didn't realise I had this separate cultural identity to you lot. And suddenly, you know, that became much more of a sort of something I was aware of. And, you know, that whole cultural history as part of me became something much more cognizant.
It's been a while.
It's the fucking Irish. We are everywhere. Like, we get everywhere. You will never find a place where there isn't an Irish pub in some way. Like, Charlie and I were talking off mic earlier about him being, an eighth?
No, I'm an eighth non-Jewish. And some of that is
Irish. Probably Irish, right? We get about
this. You should start making more movies about it.
We should probably do that.
We're getting there. We're getting more great Irish movies. First Gaelic language Oscar nominee this year.
Is Quiet Girl.
Quiet Girl, yeah.
I've not seen that movie. I was completely unaware of it. Oh. I should watch more films.
That's what I feel like you watch a lot of films.
I don't feel like... I actually think I've got trash taste. I listen to this film and every time Francesca brings something on, I'm like, what the fuck is this?
But that's exactly how I feel.
I think it's the experience of most people who come on the podcast. It's like, ah, yes, Charlie, who will bring something from the 1970s, and Francesco, which will bring something, I imagine.
Most of the films I bring on are just made up. We improvise them.
They're not real.
I would believe that.
We record the trailer audio ourselves.
Your accent work's phenomenal.
We've got very good at Foley work.
Well, the film I picked today is not one of those.
I know.
It's not.
I didn't come up with it.
Is this our first episode where everything is an English language film?
I think it might be.
I need to think about it. I'm sure there was another one. Singing in the Rain.
Yes. Mm. Yeah, that's true.
So it's been a while.
It's been a very long time. We've had two Katy Patterson episodes.
Oh, that's not true. Because the Moulin Rouge episode, isn't that all in...
Are they all English films?
Leo Carax, it's spoken in English, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, that's true. Right. That's
I mean, musicals tend to skew.
Yeah, you're right. But you managed to find a French musical.
I just don't know that many lesser-known American films, the ones I know everyone has seen.
That's right. I used to get quite insecure about not bringing enough international cinema, and I've kind of eased into, well, why would you bring that on? You can't really talk as, you know, informatively about those films.
Anyway.
So, in Bruges, I really like this film. I've seen it, like you guys, quite a few times, and I enjoy it. And there's always, like, a new joke you find each time, or a joke that you appreciate more each time. What I actually found this time really stuck with me is just how well-constructed it is, in that everything is set up early on. Like, the Americans going into the tower...
Sorry, I think making fun of Americans is always funny.
I agree.
A lot of the jokes in this movie, I think, are like, this was made in 2008 and this was fine, I think, for most, like, this was considered fine at the time, and like a lot of the language they're using, and it's kind of, it's okay for these two characters, it's mostly Colin Farrell's character who's using like
Ralph Fiennes
as well, using like a lot of slurs,
homophobic and racist slurs.
Yeah, but I think that there's that sort of element of it is that it's just making fun of Americans, and the idea of an American person being told they'll have a heart attack if they go up some stairs, and then them having a heart attack when they go up the stairs is perfect comedy. And there are a couple of movies, I think in all of these films, there is one moment in each of them that I think is just like, just absolute chef's kiss comedy.
And in terms of payoff.
Terms of just like, I think that's the funniest possible thing that could have happened right then. And like in the case of, we've spoken about this, I sent you a video of the one from Mikey and Nikki, which I think is accidental, but it's fucking hilarious all the same. Yeah, I think this movie is so funny. I think that the performances between the two of them are deeply... It's a very tender performance at the end from Brendan Gleeson. And I think that McDonough is really... I mean, Brendan Gleeson is a phenomenal actor, and he has always been a phenomenal actor, but he has a beautiful ability to just take a second and just really sit in it. And that bit at the top of the tower when he adjusts his tie, I think is just like... And he's, you know, he's pouring his coins out and all that. Not to spoil. Are we allowed to talk about it?
Title film, we absolutely spoil because we kind of assume people have seen it.
Right.
What's the point? It's a well-known film.
Oh, shit! so before he jumps off the top of that fucking tower and kills himself, his whole preparation for that and the bit where he's talking to Harry at the top and he's just like, I owe you.
Do what you got to do.
Do what you got to do. You're my friend. I'm not going to fight you. And it's like, you know, you had that whole, like, you know, you're fucking cunt kids and all that interaction immediately before. It's like, no, you're my friend. I don't want to hurt you, but I fucked you over and I know who you are, but you're my friend.
And also, like, you have to punish me in some way because that's where you are in your life and in your work. Mm. So he understands the situation far better than Colin Farrell, and arguably even better than Ralph Fiennes.
Mm. Mm. If you were to find something problematic in this film, I don't think it would be the language. I think it would be this idea of this almost like glorification of mobsters as having this very strict code of honor.
Oh, right, yeah.
I see what you mean. But I think these characters are cartoons.
Yeah.
So I don't see that as being problematic, but I can see someone making that reading, maybe.
I see what you mean. My counter to that is that the code of honor is what proves to be the undoing.
Yeah. Mm. It's the fact that the last thing he says is, it's a matter of honor or a matter of principle or whatever, and then he kills himself, and it's a matter and it's a mistake. Like he shoots.
He's so stuck in his principles that he ends
up. He's rigid.
But also the fact that, you know, Colin Farrell did this thing, and he's not a good person, but the thing that he is being targeted for was an accident. And maybe it's because his performance is so endearing, but I think a large amount of the audience can at least see why it's a bit unfair. In as much as fairness exists in this world. So it's the fact the code of honor exists is maybe a bit unrealistic and mythologizing, but it's the fact that it is so indiscriminately applied.
I agree, and I think that even more than that, it speaks to a sort of post-theocracy Irishness when they're in the gallery and they're looking at the, I think it's a like a Bruegel triptych of, you know, the end of days, and he's talking about hell and purgatory and all of that, and he's so concerned, and he asks him, it's like, do you believe in that? And he's like, what, do I believe in the bells or whatever? He's like, no, do you believe in heaven and hell? He's like, I don't know.
No, he said, purgatory, it's not when you're that bad, but not like when you're particularly good either. It's like Tottenham.
Yeah.
Do you believe in all that? What about Tottenham?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's the lot. But he's then this older Irish figure, also divorced from their country, also like has been living in England since the 70s, we assume, doesn't really have an answer about spirituality. And I know what you're going to bring up, because I knew you were going to bring this up, which is the deleted scene with Matt Smith playing Harry. Which makes no sense at all. But have you seen this, Frank?
So wait, there's one scene with Matt Smith playing Harry.
Yeah.
And okay, was he meant to play Harry throughout?
No.
Fionn can explain it.
So there is a deleted scene. You can watch it on YouTube. And it shows a younger Brendan Gleeson over his wife.
Know who plays young Brendan Gleeson. I thought it was Brian Gleeson for a while.
It might not.
I think it would have been too young. I thought it was like a young
Gleeson. It's a flashback sequence.
To like his wife's murder, and he's like, it's such and such person. I think he's a copper. I think he's a policeman.
Yeah.
And young Harry, played by Matt Smith, looking fantastic.
Really good Ralph Fiennes impression.
Yeah, excellent Ralph Fiennes in this movie impression. He then is like, don't worry, I'll take care of it. And he goes off, and you see him walking into a police station, and a machete comes out of his suit sleeve, and he chops the top of what is supposed to be a human head, but it's not. The CGI
they hadn't finished it.
So it's just like he chops the top of a melon off in the middle of this police station. And it's like, thinking about it, like sometimes I used to think, I was like, oh my God, imagine that was in the movie. And then I watched it again, I was like, where the fuck would you put that scene in this movie? There is no place where this would fit. And it works a lot better of just like, when you find out that his wife was murdered, and you find out that Harry avenged his wife, essentially. Then that's in the cocaine scene with the manky hookers and the racist dwarf.
Played by Jordan Prentice.
Not played by
Peter Dinklage, as you thought.
As I thought for
one dwarf,
several years. Oh dear.
Peter Dinklage isn't even American, is he?
He is American.
Yes, is he? Oh, he just plays British in Game of Thrones.
Yeah. You thought that was a good British accent in Game of Thrones?
No, I thought every actor in Game of Thrones is British.
Nicolas Coster-Waldau is Danish. Pedro Pascal.
Okay, literally every one of the hundreds
Charles
of actors
Dance.
In Game of Thrones.
Yeah, he is English.
Yeah. No.
Where's he from?
He's French.
Really? Aidan Gillen isn't English.
Now you're going to tell me that Jason Momoa isn't English either.
No, he is French.
He's actually pronounced Momet. Jason Momoa.
But yeah, but also I feel like a flashback like that would have like kind of established Harry as superhuman, which is what I think what makes the final chase so interesting is that there's not an action movie.
No.
It's like they feel like real characters.
What do you think of the flashback with Kieran Hines as the priest?
Just nice to see Kieran Hines.
I agree, but I think I kind of disagree that there's no place for that flashback. I just don't think it would have been a particularly good scene. It's not that I think a flashback would have been bad, but like in a film where there is already a flashback.
Yeah.
I don't think that scene's bad. I wonder if it was all, you know, in real time. Set in the present, whether we could project what happens onto Colin Farrell as well as...
The best thing that comes out of that scene, I will say, is the parallel shot, if you'll pardon the pun, of Kieran Hines being sort of murdered and then the bullets going into the back, and then you see the child in the same way at the end when the bullets go into Colin Farrell's back, and then you see Jordan Prentice, and it's the same shot that's used there.
For me, the best bit about that flashback is actually the fact that Ken comes in so so quickly.
Yeah, he's there.
And he's there, and he's there for Rey.
Mm.
I do like that it's used as a flashback, because it gives a bit of mystery as to what their backstory is. You get to know the characters, where they are now, and then you find out what led them here. And I think it can be done very powerfully. If the film started off with that, I don't know, it would have been, first of all, a really, really strong start, but then you wouldn't have had, you know, to ask yourself any questions about them.
I agree, except that scene is in the trailer, and that's such a bad decision.
I don't remember watching the trailer. It came out when I was 12.
I think my question would be, it's something we brought up ages ago, but why do we like Colin Farrell so much, despite the fact that, you know, he liberally uses ableist and homophobic slurs and stuff like that, but we hate the racist dwarf?
I don't hate the racist dwarf, but if I did...
If I was someone who hated racist dwarves.
But I feel like they made him racist so that his death at the end, which is necessary for the plot, would kind of feel like... wouldn't feel as bad?
No, I just think it's funny that he's racist.
Yeah, I think it's supposed to be... It's just because then when you see him dressed up as the little kid that, and they're laughing at him, and then they're like, and they're chatting about the film just before like the whole confrontation at the end. It's like they... You get the impression that he seems sort of like embarrassed. And yeah, he was saying that. He's saying that stuff. And he is a dick, but I don't think that there's anyone in this film that you are supposed to really dislike.
Yeah, not even Harry.
Not even Harry. Like, Harry comes across just as sort of like, yeah, obviously a fucking psychopath.
No, there is. Eric.
Which one's Eric? Oh my god, yes! The blind guy!
But even he gets his moments where, like, no, I feel bad for him.
No, I don't. He brought it on himself completely.
Harry's monologue when they're with the alcove guy is one of the funniest. Yuri the alcove guy, I think, is one of the funniest bits where he just, like, completely deconstructs it. If you allowed him to get that close with a gun that has no bullets.
That sounds like it's all your fault. I hate this guy. I'm going to kill this guy. But, you're like, yeah, you're in the wrong here.
You're clearly a fucking idiot. And that's so good. He's so pathetic.
But I know what you mean. I think what I would say is that Harry, Ken, and Ray exist in a world that is shown to be unforgiving, violent, and corrupt.
Mm.
So him saying these things, first of all, in 2008, where it can be played for laughs rather than necessarily a mark of a deeply, you know, problematic worldview.
More just a problematic society.
Agreed. But they are bad guys who we enjoy spending time with.
Mm.
Yes, Jimmy is a small person, but his racism feels much more unwarranted for the world that he lives in.
Mm. It's also incredibly thought out, for lack of a better word. Like,
that's cocaine, man.
Yeah, no, that is
a hell of a drug.
Yeah, that is cocaine, but also, like, I appreciate the world building he does.
But like, Colin Farrell is so, like, casually bigoted, like, in a way that it's like, oh yeah, this guy grew up around language like that being used.
But also,
he doesn't know that it's problematic. The other
like
guy,
Brendan,
like,
Gleeson and the girl.
I was literally going to say, I'm Irish, being racist is part of my culture.
Yeah, but he does it on purpose. It's kind of tongue in cheek in the guard. I feel like Colin Farrell just, like, he's only deliberately racist against Americans.
Yeah.
Like, they're the only people who, like, he actively has prejudice against. Everything else is just like, he's just so passive and casual about it that's like, you're not really going to fix this guy. The dwarf, however, he cares about race.
He's like a QAnon racist.
He doesn't want the Vietnamese. He's mad. But it's also that whole scene, like, and obviously they're all completely fucked up in very different ways, but Colin Farrell has this look in his eyes. He's like goading him on, and he keeps on getting more and more annoyed. He's like, yes, the Asians will be on their side. And he just keeps on going, and he's just like, what about the Vietnamese? Just like grinning at him with this sort of like, go on, keep pushing yourself. Go on, you silly fuck.
I love the... My favorite bit of like that whole sequence is when he's, you know, interrupted Jimmy and his and the sex worker he's with, and he's saying, "Do you want some cocaine?"
And then Brendan Gleeson, yes,
the face Brendan Gleeson is pulling, and it's just like so coked out of his mind. It is so funny. And it actually, a thing I meant to say earlier was talking about Brendan Gleeson's face and just how like endearing it is just to let him sit in emotion. Is the sort of endearingness of his performances directly proportional to how much of his face is exposed?
You're saying that big-faced guys like Brendan Gleeson...
No, I'm saying clean-shaven Brendan Gleeson specifically.
Ah, I see.
So, like, Troy, Kingdom of Heaven, he's got a big beard.
Big beard, bad guy.
Calvary,
good guy, but bad institution. Small beard,
oh, you're right.
But he's not... But it's... It doesn't... I think it's a great performance in Calvary, and I think that's a wonderful film, but I don't think it has the same effect as his face does in this, or The Guard, or in Banshee's Inisherin. Mm-hmm. Just something about his face and the way
the
that
Brendan Gleeson beard taxonomy could be a great thing for your film thesis.
It's true. But anyway, that's all I wanted to bring up. And it was, I kind of meant it. It was quite serious.
No, I think that you're absolutely right, because then you can see he has very immensely expressive eyes. And actually, so does Colin Farrell, has those enormous dark puppy dog eyes that just kind of stare up. And when you're saying, like, why do we like him? It's because sometimes he does that face where he gets all cute. And
He's a cute boy.
He's a cute... And he looks... Like, I mean... I don't
he
know
still
exactly.
look. He doesn't look much older now.
He looks quite a bit older now.
15, no, not 15 years older.
I don't know. I mean, not in Banshees of Inisherin, I think he does. In Banshees of Inisherin, I think he does. He looks his age, but that's probably deliberate. I think in this film, despite the fact that he's a man in his 30s, I should think, who has just come out of a very famous struggle with addiction, like, he has this sort of vulnerability to him that he expresses through. He has these beautiful way of... Colin Farrell hunches in a very good way. And
especially when he's got a big coat.
Everyone's hunches well in a big coat, as we will learn later on in our conversation. But I think there is something about he seems always like he's trying to protect himself, whereas actually Brendan Gleeson, with his big open face and his big kind eyes, and he has this huge smile on when he's talking about things.
He's got big uncle energy.
Yes, and unfortunately, Brendan Gleeson does remind me of my deceased uncle, and always has done, even when the deceased uncle was walking.
Well, why is that unfortunate?
No, it's not actually unfortunate. It's unfortunate he's dead.
Oh, yeah, that is unfortunate, I suppose.
And it's still unfortunate that I love watching Brendan Gleeson films, so every time I watch it, I'm like, Brendan.
No, I've been there.
Yeah, so I like this film. I like this film a lot. I think that it's really well made. I think it's brilliantly well acted and really well written.
Okay. Do we have any final thoughts?
No, I think if we come up with anything else, we can probably tie it into the alternates we're going to choose.
Yes,
in the interest of time, let's talk availability. If you want to watch this film and haven't already, you can rent it on Amazon, Google Play, Microsoft, YouTube, Apple TV+, Sky Store, and Rakuten TV.
Rakuten TV, the thinking man's renting channel.
And you can buy it on all those channels. I'm never quite sure if it's Apple TV or if it's should be called iTunes, but the logo is Apple TV.
I think it's Apple TV.
It's the same thing.
But you buy it on it, whatever. But it's important to keep in that we struggled over this.
Mm.
All right, let's play the trailer for our next film.
On a night like this, there are no rules.
Die. You're not gonna die.
What do you think they're planning? To shoot you in a movie house?
Mikey and Nikki.
I'm really getting the treatment tonight. Tonight's my night.
Okay, Mikey and Nikki is a 1976 film directed by Elaine May. In Philadelphia, Nikki, a small-time bookie who stole mob money, is in hiding, and he begs Mikey, a childhood friend, to help him evade the hitman who's on his trail.
That's pretty good synopsis.
Who is the hitman on his trail?
Ned Beatty.
Ned Beatty, another large-faced gentleman.
I chose this movie because it is, you know, it involves hitmen, but it's mostly about two people with a complicated relationship debating matters of religion, of morality, while also dealing with the fact that one of them has screwed over a powerful criminal. So, on the surface, it's got some real similarities.
On the surface, In Bruges is almost a direct remake of Mikey and Nikki.
A family remake.
Yeah, it's a family-friendly remake of Mikey and Nikki.
I don't think it is as much. I think it is more influenced by Harold Pinter's The Dumbwaiter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we literally just mentioned that, but I think...
We mentioned Pinter, but specifically The
Dumbwaiter, because that is about the two hitmen. But I think it's impossible. Like, now that I've seen it, I couldn't think of it without thinking of...
I will just say one more thing about The Dumbwaiter. The names that they book the hotel under, those are the names of the characters in The Dumbwaiter.
Go away. Really?
Yeah.
I had no idea.
But yeah, this film has been on my watch list forever. I was recommended it by a number of friends, and I'm so happy I watched it. I don't know if I would have made that direct of a comparison with In Bruges if I'd seen it like separately, but watching it in this context, I was like, oh my God, it's so obvious. Yeah. I think the caveat is that in Bruges, you are meant to like Colin Farrell. Here, Nicky, like,
such a piece of
oh
shit.
Oh God, like, it's hard to sit through. And
Nicky challenges you to like him.
Yeah.
I don't think.
It's like, I dare you, find something to like about him.
Every time you think maybe there's something good in him, he's just like, no, I'm a cunt.
I'm a manipulative sociopath whose luck has run out.
Yeah.
Don't feel sorry for me.
Well, one thing I think that Cassavetes, I was saying this to Charlie off, one thing I really like about Cassavetes.
We had dinner before this.
Charlie and I went out for dinner earlier.
The Chinese round the corner is very nice.
It was actually really good. There is something about Cassavetes' face where he looks like someone who was handsome 10 years ago and has never quite gotten over that. And he holds himself as someone who thinks he still has the charm he had in his 20s.
Yeah. Fionn, can you tell us how you know about that feeling?
Well, I'm something of a clairvoyant. I've seen my own future, and I hope, now that I've seen Mikey and Nicky, I know what not to do. Thank you, Elaine May.
But yeah, I think there is something really about that. You can kind of see that Peter Falk is a guy that maybe had if he had a rise, it's a more steady rise, whereas Cassavetes has the more extreme highs and lows. But you liked this film, Francesca?
A lot.
Good.
Yeah. I did.
I also thought it was a good film.
I think it is a perfect film, and yet it isn't even my favourite Elaine May film, which is something considering she made 4 movies.
I really need to watch some more Elaine May films.
Is your favourite The Heartbreak Kid?
Yeah.
Well, we'll mention it later, because there might be an actor in that.
It's all coming together, audience.
Yeah,
the pairing of the two of them, like,
Real life good friends.
Yeah, and that comes across. The chemistry is incredible. And there's a brilliant... When he finally sort of cajoles Cassavetes out of the apartment and they're kind of like racing down the stairs, there's a bit where Falk kind of gets in front of him. He's like sticking his tongue out and it's like they play like they're kids.
There's kind of a weird... Especially in that first bit when they're trading coats...
There's
like a weird like Abbott and Costello thing going on.
Yeah, exactly.
They're more like a double act than they are like two criminals.
Well, because I know that Elaine May comes from improv comedy, and Cassavetes in the films that he directed and made used a lot of improvisation. Is there an improvisation in this film, or is it like scripted but like made in a style that feels improvisational?
It's complicated. There is. I know what Fionn wants to say, and you're gonna have to wait.
I will wait.
But it is more scripted than you think. Mm-hmm. It isn't like you say, okay, we're rolling, just go. Because that's... Elaine May is, as well as a great improviser, a very good writer. Took her a year to edit this film, by the way.
I'm not surprised.
Because even though like it is scripted, she did say, okay, we're going to do like multiple takes and just do what you want with the script. But they largely stayed on the script. Do you want to just guess how much they filmed?
Having done some improv stuff before, I would say there is probably upwards of 10 hours of footage of this film.
Do you have a guess?
10 hours? That sounds...
I don't have it in hours, but they shot 1.4 million feet of film. For context, that is 3 times more than Gone with the Wind.
Why?
Which is a 4-hour movie.
And this is an hour 40 minutes.
This isn't a long movie.
It's not a long movie at all.
Because they would just keep rolling and just seeing what they do.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it feels like, obviously, the dialogue is scripted, but a lot of the overlaps, the ums and ahs, a lot of those things, I was wondering if they were scripted as well.
Well, they probably did the same line like multiple times in different ways.
Which is a nightmare to edit. Especially if you're doing shot reverse shot, where you have to like match the, you know, lips of
something about the editing as well is so much of this film is shot in darkness or is shot like with them out, like, especially the early parts of the film, is shot with like without them really in frame, and it's like it forces sort of the the viewer as this kind of, it's really voyeuristic, and you feel like you're almost intruding on it, and it's just like these tight angles, especially in like the graveyard scene, which I think is one of my favourite scenes in the film, for a multitude of reasons.
Nicky, you're making me forget the cash.
You take that back.
Was this 35 mil?
Yeah.
259 hours.
That's more than 10.
No, 1.4 million.
Yeah.
That's what this calculator says.
No, that sounds right. Like, I cannot... They started filming this in 1973. It comes out in 76.
Fucking hell.
Also consider, this is on location in Philadelphia.
They just have to keep on... That would be a nightmare. It's all...
It was a nightmare. That's the point.
But that's what I loved about it, the fact they were shot on location.
And not in New York.
And not in New York. But there is something about the way that this film is shot. It's entirely a night shoot on location with natural light, which means that very often when they're outdoors, you cannot see anything. Mm. But there are so many clever placement of like car highlights or just a little light coming in through the side. And it feels, you know how nowadays so many Hollywood films are done in a way that is meant to mimic natural light at night and you can't see shit. But like you really cannot see anything and everything looks like very digitalized and blurry. Whereas in this film, it's like proper like pitch black, like you cannot discern any faces, but there's like a little point of light here and there that's placed either deliberately or
it looks amazing,
and it just looks like natural lightning.
We've talked on this podcast about how nostalgia has the potential to be a very toxic impulse. However, when you do watch a film like this, it is very hard not to be depressed at the fact that a film like this can get made with the stars are John Cassavetes, Peter Falk, and Ned Beatty.
Yeah, I mean, they literally don't make them like that anymore. And by I mean
maybe they shouldn't.
These films, like, it's such a...
76 was a good year for film.
The background noise, like in the opening scene, which goes on for a while in the apartment, is there's no score, which is first of all quite interesting. It's just those sort of like strange shots where that's half their faces. And when they get outside, so much of this, the background noise, is just that sort of like low, distant honking of cars and of like, you know, slow moving, of like, you know, minimal traffic sounds. And that's just it makes you feel like you are being dragged along somewhat unwillingly alongside Mikey by Nicky. It's just like every time he changes his mind on something, it's like, oh, for fuck's sake, what the fuck is happening now? And you just bounce from place to place with them and you feel so involved in the whole process.
Have you ever had a friend who, when they're drunk, they are completely unrestrainable?
Charlie, do you know anyone like that?
I don't know if you know any. I looked at you and you looked at me and I think we might both be thinking of each other.
Yeah, that's fair. I was thinking, like, I know I do this, but only Charlie though, he does it too.
Yeah. Well, something that I think is that what makes both these characters so engaging is that everyone has been both Mikey and Nicky in a relationship at some point in their lives.
Yeah.
Maybe not Francesco, because he's perfect.
Yeah.
Francesco is Ned Beatty.
He's M.M. at Walsh, the bus driver.
There is a bit...
Nicky, he's huge!
There is a bit of Nicky in all of us, hopefully minus the...
Minus the horrible parts of
harassment and sexual harassment that he goes... Yeah.
It's more just the sort of, like, I'm really drunk and I've decided to not trust my friend because I think they're plotting against me.
Yeah. Which, you know what? Credit where credit's due.
If you're sat there listening to this and you're like, I've never done that, you're a liar. You're lying to yourself.
You have a victim complex.
You have a victim complex, and you are not always Mikey.
But I do think that first scene where he's alone in the apartment and he's reading the newspaper, that does so much work in just setting up the story and the conflict.
Yeah.
And Cassavetes himself, and also the way that Elaine May frames it and edits it, without any dialogue, you get what's going on so quickly. And I think when a film can be that efficient with its storytelling, it's insane that they filmed 1.4 million feet of film.
It's so claustrophobic. Imagine being those two guys just having to hang out with you. I mean, it's lucky they're friends. You couldn't make that film with two people who didn't already like each other a great deal.
Peter Falk was already attached, and he mentioned it to John Cassavetes, and Cassavetes was like, you got me, I'll do it. And he's like, no, I wasn't asking, I'm talking to you about this film I'm in. And he's like, no, I'll do it. It's a lame mate, it sounds good, and you're in it, I'll do it.
Stop to us, I'm begging me, I'll do the film with you, Pete.
Which makes him perfect to play Mickey. Peter Falk, of course, one of a kind, played Columbo until his death. I love Peter Falk.
I really love Peter Falk. I watched like part of this movie with a friend, and then it just got very late, and I went to sleep. it was dark, and I was like, "Whoa, no!" I need to watch this in the daylight. And
well, you can see even less.
It turns out I can see less of the scale of the film, but it was. They pointed out to me that Peter Falk is the granddad in The Princess Bride.
Yes,
and I didn't know that, and I kept. I'm just like, I paused it on a shot of his face, and I just kind of stared at it and mentally attached a beard, and I was like, "Oh, so it is." It was really nice for me.
He's also in Shark Tale.
Cassavetes dies in 89. It's amazing.
Ripped to a real one.
He dies at 59, which like isn't old, but is way older than you would think he would live to after watching Mikey and Nicky.
Yeah, did it? So one thing I was curious about: did Cassavetes have any sort of like substance issues?
Yes,
as, like
a big drinker.
That makes sense with his face.
And also, he was a movie star in the 70s, which meant he had a million cigarettes a day.
Was Cassavetes considered the star? I know he was in Rosemary's Baby.
Well, he was small role. In Rosemary's Baby, though.
No, it's the husband.
Is he
the husband? Yeah.
Oh, shit. Well,
he was more known as like an actor-director.
Yeah, but he directed independent films. He didn't direct big studio productions.
But like, he was sort of known more for the things that he directed and being like a bit of a wild card.
He's also kind of a precursor to New Hollywood, because he directed a lot of independent films in the 60s before New Hollywood exploded. So maybe by the 70s he was like a household name.
Yeah, he's sort of like between, because he's in 1964 he's in The Killers, and he, which is sort of a bridge between classic Hollywood and New Hollywood. So I think he's just before like the De Niro's and the Pacinos, but I think he is a precursor to that sort of
style
of directing and acting. Mm. I think he's very good in this film, but he does look like shit.
Yeah. I think there's a really, moving back towards In Bruges and sort of those parallels, I love the scene with the mob boss who I...
Sanford Meisner, I think. Who is like the Meisner technique.
Yeah. Sanford Meisner as Resnick. And you've had that scene earlier on where they've had this confrontation, Mikey and Nicky, and Nicky has told him that he doesn't like you. This mob boss just doesn't like you. You make him uncomfortable, blah, blah, blah. And then he's just kind of sat there like watching Resnick just... And he apologizes like, "I'm sorry you don't like me."
Oh, but that's more of a... He's not like... It's not a pull. It's more of like a power move.
Yeah, it is. But it really reminded me then of that scene in the square between Brendan Gleeson and Ralph Fiennes, of this confrontation between the two. And it's just a very relaxed conversation that is also kind of a confrontation as well. I think that, just reminded me of that, as many things did. Going back to this, the hilarious moment in this film is a moment that's definitely improvised, which is when they're having a slap fight, or when they're having it like they're wrestling when they get off after the watch is broken, and then, or actually maybe before the watch is broken.
Maybe it's what causes the watch to break.
Nicky throws the watch on the ground, and that causes Mikey to start a fight with him.
And Peter Falk just like hammers him with a couple of punches, and then they're up and they're kind of looking at each other, and Cassavetes just kind of like stretches out and slaps him across the face, and then immediately slips over and falls.
It's like in a puddle.
And I rewatched that like maybe 5 or 6 times, and every time he fell over I was like, no, that cannot be faked.
No, they actually wrestled each other. Like,
I know. Yeah, 100%. That's I know what wrestling with your friends looks like. Looks like that.
Not usually with quite as many clothes.
Not usually. That's also true. And that's why this movie is another movie about the boys.
Yeah. Do you mind if we just do a quick sidebar and Fionn can explain to us his theory about what makes a movie about the boys?
It's not much of a theory so much as it is just sort of a belief that there are certain... unsurprisingly, due to the nature of the patriarchy, there are lots of films with men in them. I'm sure if you gentlemen are aware of this. But as a consequence of this, some movies are just about the boys. We happen to have picked 3 of the 4 films that we have today are very distinctly about the boys with different sort of gradients. For instance, Mikey and Nicky is about the boys, but about the boys in a sad way.
Yeah.
As is In Bruges. However, Midnight Run, definitely a movie about the boys. Happy. You got those saxophones on that soundtrack. You've got that good Danny Elfman music. And it's like, you know, it's propelling you forward is a movie about the boys that's happy. If you're looking for other categories, you have movies about the boys, but the boys are America. And that is things like...
Saving Private Ryan.
Saving Private Ryan.
Easy Rider.
Easy Rider.
The boys are America in
that
movie.
The boys are America, quite literally. And then you have movies about the boys, but the category is simply sweeping. You are swept along with the boys, like Master and Commander, or Up.
Or Big Trouble in Little China.
Big Trouble in...
That is sweeping.
That is... I don't know if that's about the boys.
Oh, it is.
That's about a boy.
No, it's about him and his boys.
Oh, I suppose.
So they go into the place as boys.
As boys, yeah, I suppose. And then, of course, you have the movies about the boys that are happy. These are few and far between. The main one I can think of is The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai and the Aliens of the Tenth Dimension, which you will see at some point, but it is not this day.
Is Phantom of the Paradise a movie about the boys?
No.
No.
It's a movie about the beef.
It's a movie about the beef.
But this is a movie about the boys, but written by a woman who, like, we're making it sound like a comedy. Also, it's Elaine May, if you watched The Heartbreak Kid that we talked about last time.
So this is Elaine May after making two comedies.
Yeah, and it's not really a comedy. No. Like, we're just focusing on what we find funny, but it's a very dark, horrible film. They do some horrible things. There are some scenes that are genuinely...
They are very hard to watch.
Like, grueling to sit through, especially in the way that the two of them treat women.
The character Nellie, played by Carol Grace. Great performance.
You know, apparently she... I looked this film up immediately after watching it. Apparently she is someone who is very often thought to be the influence. She was a friend of, like, Truman Capote, and she was thought to be the influence behind his character Holly Golightly. Just like at her, like, getting about, she was this sort of like socialite-ish presence in New York.
But whereas in The Heartbreak Kid, it's a movie about a guy being horrible to women, but he's the butt of the joke, and you know he's gonna get his comeuppance, and it's funny. Here is just hard to sit through. Like, it's just a bit too real.
Oh, but comeuppance do be coming, though.
It do be coming, but, like, you don't feel good about it. No, you just feel gross.
The comeuppance happens, and it's genuinely horrible.
Yeah.
But also, the comeuppance on the audience, which I think is what you're describing, it's almost like, because up to that point, Fionn alluded to people kidding themselves by totally identifying with Mikey and never Nicky, which is unrealistic. But what that scene does is say, oh, you think you're Mikey? Fine. This is who Mikey is. And he also does a terrible thing.
That's a really good point. It's just like that whole last half an hour, really, which separates the two. And you see a lot more of who they are. And it's like, you know, Mikey has been putting up this front. It's like, oh, I need to call my family. And, you know, he's ringing home to check on his wife, ostensibly to check on his wife. And when he's actually there at home, he's dismissive of her. He's rude to her.
To be fair, he's had a long night.
He's had a long night. But at the same time, it's like the way that women are treated in this movie, they are these people who just have to suffer through. And
but like, they thread such a fine needle, because the women are there to be played upon by these horrible men, and Mikey and Nicky both. However, they are also fully realized characters while being secondary characters.
Yeah, and I guess the difference is also that in The Heartbreak Kid, you can expect that by the end of it, the women in the film have got what they wanted. They're in a better place than where they started.
Well, Sybil Shepherd isn't.
Oh, no, she got...
She marries Charles Grodin.
Yeah, but it's on her terms. And
She
chooses to do it. Whereas here, there's really no winners.
No.
And to what you were saying about Mikey's wife, but there's also the scene where he tells Nicky, oh, yeah, I tell my wife everything. She knows everything about my childhood. And then when he speaks to his wife, she doesn't even know that his brother died.
Yeah.
Like,
but that's such a good point. And he seems shocked by that. And it's almost as if that self-deception that we talk about that Nicky has of sort of like, oh, he thinks he's this sort of like untouchable kind of man about town. The self-deception that Mikey has is that, oh, I am this sort of, I'm different to Nicky.
I'm respectable.
I live... And he even says it's like... It's quite an exclusive neighbourhood, he says. And it's like you're not really. You are just as private. You are still someone who has made their money in the same way that Nicky has.
We never quite get it, but
he
seems to be... Yeah, connected is the word.
Yeah.
Like, he can sit down with Resnick.
Yeah.
And apparently, kind of based on... Not that Elaine May's family were connected, but she definitely, like... new people growing up in, you know, a Jewish ghetto in America in, like, the 1930s and 40s.
Mm. Well, you might do, yeah.
It's what they
There'd
say.
There'd be a couple of characters, I imagine.
But before we finish this, I just want to quickly just put a spotlight on what I think is the secret source of this movie, and that is Ned Beatty.
Normal hitman in the world.
He's so relatable. He's the only relatable character.
He is. Yes, he's a hitman, but he's just sort of doing the job.
But doesn't he say he wants to, like, he's putting the money away somewhere? He wants to open up, like, a hardware store or something like that?
And he's complaining, like, oh, if I could have hired a driver, that would have been easier, but then I'd have made less money.
They talk so much about parking in this film.
It's so funny.
You can't park outside my house. It's a very exclusive neighborhood.
You're obsessed with the exclusive
neighborhood. I am obsessed with the exclusive neighborhood. I think it's such a weird thing.
But, like, he's like, yeah, I couldn't kill him because I wouldn't have been able to park him. But, like, he's just so done with it, and he's not, like, a cool him. And neither are Ken and Ray in Bruges.
No.
But he takes it to another level.
Yeah, he's just Ned Beatty. He's just, like, the most normal American-looking man in the world.
Great actor.
Great actor. Just a big fat face.
One nomination for an Oscar in his life for his performance in The Best Film Ever Made, Network.
Okay.
That comes out this year as well.
Deliverance.
Yes.
Yeah, he's good in that one.
Oh, shit, he is in Deliverance, isn't he?
And he's in Superman.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was another film.
I'm sure he's in Nashville.
I think he's in Toy Story 3.
I think he might be.
Can't quite recognise him there.
Every, like, Borscht Belt character actor was in that movie.
And I repeat.
He's in Rango.
Rango's a great movie.
You can't stream this anywhere, but you can watch it if you're in America on the Criterion Channel, and there is a very good Criterion copy of this that you can order if you buy physical media. There's also a cut of it on YouTube. For now, anyway.
Yeah, it will immediately leave after this podcast is released.
But, yeah, that is Mikey and Nikki, and let's move on to our next film.
Oh, it's going to be a quick one.
You think so?
It's going to be a midnight run.
Robert De Niro is bringing Charles Grodin into custody.
I can't fly. I also suffer from acrophobia and claustrophobia.
I'll tell you what, if you don't cooperate, you're going to suffer from fistophobia.
It could be the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
You are the dumbest bounty hunters I've ever seen!
From the director of Beverly Hills Cop.
Come on, cigarettes are killers.
Midnight Run.
Just relax.
I'm totally relaxed.
Midnight Run, a 1988 film directed by Martin Brest. Jack Walsh, a bounty hunter, is tasked with retrieving Jonathan Mardukas, an accountant who embezzled $50 million of mob money. The two are then chased by other bounty hunters, the FBI, and the Mafia. Now, shout out to my friend Ollie for recommending this. I wouldn't have come up with it myself. Ollie's definitely going to be a guest on the show in the future. And this film is really, really good. What do you guys think?
So fucking good.
It's really good.
It's so good. Yeah. I love this movie. I was watching it. I texted Charlie. I was like, I think I'm going to like this movie. And then the title card appeared and the Elfman soundtrack really kicked in. And I was like, fuck yeah. It was. I knew immediately it was my exact favorite kind of movie, which is movies that have saxophones featured prominently.
Just the opening scene were like, you're not cops.
Nobody just decks, what's his name, Dorfman?
Dorfler.
We just decks the other bounty. When Jack Walsh, played by Robert De Niro, it's an ongoing joke where he just keeps on punching this other bounty hunter in the face in the exact same way, and it's so good every time.
But it builds and has such a good payoff. Yeah, Dorfler, played by John Ashton.
Yes.
It's like such a good 80s scumbag.
Yes, brilliant 80s scumbag.
There are a lot of good scumbags in this movie.
Oh, absolutely.
But yeah, the central buddy duo is Robert De Niro and Charles Grodin of Heartbreak Kid fame.
Yeah, and who was also at least considered at one point, I think, to play Nicky in Mikey Nicky. Or maybe he was going to be Mikey and then Fork was going to be Nicky.
Yeah, because he always plays the straight man in comedy duos.
Yeah, I don't know. I love Grodin, I think. He has such a bit of a scumbag energy, but like it, which is done really well here because it undercuts like a character who like purports to be very upstanding and generous.
He's got a real twinkle in his eyes, and it's just everything he says, it's just like, I'm being completely upright with you. And it's like, well, I don't trust you, Charles Grodin. Something about the way you said trust me makes me think you're a liar. And he is a liar, but in a good way.
Well, he starts off as this kind of like goody two shoes character who's like lecturing Robert De Niro about his diet, he has all these phobias, but then turns out that he's quite a bit more tongue-in-cheek than that, and it's like smartly using his like innocent accountant appearance to his advantage.
He's smarter than he looks.
Yeah.
He's more wily than he looks.
That's the thing, because it's like, you know he's smart because he managed to steal all of that money and get away with it.
Yeah.
But you then see, like, he puts up this sort of facade of not being very streetwise.
Which never quite works. To the movie's credit, it's never totally believable because it's Charles Grodin.
Yeah. And it's just even the fact that, you know, you're watching a film about this guy who stole $15 million. It's like, you gotta know
something else going on.
But he gave most of it to charity.
I think this film has a lot of interesting things to say about masculinity, and I don't think it intended to when it was made. I think it was made to be a fun movie with Robert De Niro and Charles Grodin.
Okay, what don't you think it intended to? I think... Okay.
I mean, it might well have done. I don't know. Maybe I'm...
You mean like at the very early stages?
At the very early stages, potentially. And I think that there's something about the way that Robert De Niro's character, at the drop of a hat, will tell someone about, like, all of his emotional vulnerabilities. He's so desperate for connection, for having someone around. Like, you know, he hasn't seen his wife or his kid for years. Like, you know, he's been kicked out of the police force, so obviously meant a lot to him. And he's working on his own. His only friend is Joey Pants, who we will get to later.
Trust me, we will get to later.
And then as soon as someone asks him a question, he's like, oh, you want to know? Oh, fine, you unzip me. And just like, here's why I'm very sad. And it's just, as the movie goes on, you just start to see him like relying on Grodin's kind of, you know, his chiding, almost like his big brotherly behavior. He's just like, I want someone to vent to. Come on.
You know who he really reminds me of?
Who?
And I don't think intentionally, Robert Hayes in Airplane.
that's a good comparison. Yeah,
he ordered Charles Grodin to just set himself on fire at some point,
just start hanging himself.
But then the question I guess we'll ask in each of these films is who is the Colin Farrell, who is the Brendan Gleeson? And I'd say that in terms of their body dynamic, Robert De Niro is clearly more the Colin Farrell, because Charles Grodin is much more, you know,
stoic.
The straight man, stoic, like very serious. But in terms of the relationship to the resident mobster,
Yaphet
Kotto is the FBI agent.
I know he's the FBI agent, but he's the one who has all of the gravitas.
Oh, God.
Looks like a hammerhead shark.
Jimmy Serrano.
Oh, Jimmy Serrano.
Jimmy Serrano, the
Dennis Farina.
Farina, who he is the Ray Fiennes of this film. He just spends half of the film just shouting into a phone until he makes a physical appearance.
I'm going to stab you in the heart with a fucking pencil.
Robert De Niro is more the Brendan Gleeson in the sense that he is an antagonistic force, this guy that has offended this mobster.
He's also the more streetwise of the two. He's got a history with the mobster, and the two have some weird mutual respect with each other, whereas Charles Grodin is just the guy that Tony Serrano wants dead.
But all he wants to do is open a coffee shop.
All he wants to do is open a coffee shop with $100,000, which is something that could have been possible in 1988. And you can't even buy a house for $100,000
in London. Retirement money, Jesus.
Oh, God. It's...
Oh, God.
That upset. Like, I watched that. I was like, oh, God, it's not even that long ago.
But I think casting Dennis Farina as Jimmy Serrano is, you know, such like good shorthand, because you don't need to spend that much time with him, and you're like, okay, I get it. You're like a Vegas mob boss. We've seen these movies. We know the function you have. But he manages, that's not to say he doesn't do it very well.
He has he's a very distinct character, I think, from other people who have done that exact same role.
Sure, but the point of that character isn't, in the way that like Ralph Fiennes is actively fighting against the stereotypes of like the London gangster by, you know, having his like real sticking points. He is playing, he might have like foibles and quirks, but Dennis Farina is like, he's doing the job.
Yeah, if anything, I think Robert De Niro is the one who's more playing around the stereotype of the grizzled bounty hunter. He's got this code of honor. He refuses several payouts that would be larger than the 100K because he took a job and he respects it. In that case, he's very similar to the protagonists in Bruges.
Well, not only is Robert De Niro like a Chicago cop, which is super, super masculine, he is a Chicago cop who left the force because he wouldn't take a payout.
Yeah, it's like his good guy points are really stacked up.
But then, like, as soon as he opens his mouth, you're like, something different's going on.
But that's why he's so similar to Colin Farrell in a way.
Yeah, I see what you mean, but I think he is... it takes more time to open up, whereas I think Colin Farrell, to me at least, is like a sweetie from the beginning.
Yeah.
Because he's Colin Farrell.
Yeah.
But there's also the scene in Midnight Run where he meets with his estranged wife and daughter, which I was just so emotional.
It was really nice. And the fact that when his wife leaves and he just stood there with his daughter, and they can't actually say anything to each other, and it's so awkward, and it really hangs on that moment for a while of this sort of, like, you can see De Niro, like, I don't think you can see the daughter's face at all in the shot, you just see him just sort of, like, almost start a conversation several times, and it doesn't quite happen. And then when they leave, and she runs out and gives him some, like, all of her babysitting money, it's like, I think when I watched it, there was a part of me, like, a cynical part of me, I was like, oh, I wish I hadn't done that. But then also, it's like, no, actually, it's quite nice.
And I also think the fact that these two characters don't hate him, I think speaks a lot to his character. He didn't leave.
Because he hasn't got back in touch with his, and hasn't seen his daughter in a very long time, which, you know, I was thinking, maybe you could, yes, your wife left you, but...
But I think it's a self-imposed exile.
I agree, and it is totally believable and also relatable that the daughter would want to, you know, help him.
But also the assumption that if he were to go back to Chicago, first traffic stop,
yeah,
you know, every cop is against him, every mobster in the town is against him. He doesn't have a hit on him, but he can't really go back.
Yeah.
And he definitely can't be a bounty hunter.
Yeah.
In Chicago.
Yeah, because he doesn't have the relationships. Another thing I really like about this film is just that he's really good at his job.
I love it when people are good at their jobs.
It's like competency. It's just like, yeah, he just immediately finds him. Like, he immediately finds the Duke. And it's just sort of like, yeah, that was fucking easy.
Although that reveal where he's arresting him. And he's trapped in the bath by a massive dog.
He's got the gun. And he's like, don't fucking move. Take the dog in.
But he's held back by his humanity because there's...
Also the fact that he's not a cop.
But there's that parallel scene where Charles Grodin is pulling the I'm afraid of flying stunt. And Robert De Niro humors him and he's like, okay, we're going to take the train. But when the other guy does it, he just decks him in the face and knocks him out. So, like, you get the sense that if Robert De Niro had fewer scruples, he would get over some of his weaknesses.
Yeah. He'd be a better bounty hunter, but a worse person.
Exactly. Yeah. We would like him less.
And if that's true, there's that balance, isn't there? And that's something that Brendan Gleeson's character in Bruges has, of, like, when he's going to kill Colin Farrell, he stops because he's going to kill himself, and he's like, well, no, actually, like, the reality of that, of that this person is so mentally unwell, is so, feels so awful about what they've done that they are going to do this, triggers him to be a better person and to allow his humanity to overcome his sort of sense of loyalty to Harry, to Ralph Fiennes.
So he's already paid for what he's done. He's suffering.
Yeah, and in that same way, seeing, like, speaking to a Duke, learning more about, like, the fact, you know, he took money from someone who he's sort of hates, who completely loathes, who cost him his whole life. And that sort of allows that humanity to come through as the film progresses.
The reason why I don't particularly get on with the comparisons between Ken and Ray and Grodin and De Niro in this film is that neither of them really function effectively as the mentor in the way that Ken or Gleeson does. Grodin is actively trying to give De Niro emotional counsel, but A, it's pretty banal and pretty obvious stuff, and also it falls on deaf ears.
But also, like in Bruges, and Mackie and Nicky, one, the two of them don't have a history. We see them meet each other for the first time, and two, they're from two very different worlds.
It's a new relationship that develops.
Yeah.
Whereas, to very different degrees, you're right, Mike and Nicky and in Bruges both have pre-established relationships to some extent.
Mm-hmm. And also, they're both mobsters in those films.
And in Bruges, they're both Irish. Yeah. So there is that also that commonality.
Whereas only one of these actors is Irish.
You're never going to let this go, that Robert De Niro.
No, Robert De Niro is Irish. He's more Irish than he's Italian. It's important that people understand that is still a through line of this episode, is Irish actors. Except John Cassavetes and Peter Falk, who are not Irish.
No, Peter Falk is extremely Jewish.
And John Cassavetes, we may never know where he's from.
Oh, look at that. Born in New York City, the son of Greek-American actress. He's Greek. I know languages.
You can spot a Greek from a mile away.
We tried to invade them in World War II. We failed.
Good. I'm glad that you did that.
Yeah, this might be a controversial take, but, you know, Italians in World War II, I don't think they were the good guys.
Kind of cringe.
Yeah.
It's problematic.
Low-key mid.
It was Italy in its flop era.
It's Disney's been in its flop era since AD 437.
They are no longer serving cunt.
Okay, what else? I feel like...
Oh, what else?
What else?
What else indeed, sir?
What else?
Joseph Pantoliano. Joey Pants.
Charlie,
talk about Joey Pants.
Joey Pants is one of the greatest character actors of all time, and he is a little weirdo.
It's a little
and
fucking
I
freak.
Love him in this film. I love the idea that someone said, okay, Joey, you can have braces, you can have a colourful shirt, you can have a goatee, and you can have a comb over, and you can have an earring. Which one do you want? And he was like, all of them.
And they said, yes, yes, absolutely. And this is the worst comb over
of
all time.
He looks like pure shit, and he's so good.
Such a gross little rat fuck. I love him.
He's so good. For those of you who aren't familiar with his work, you probably best know him as Cypher in The Matrix.
Or from his...
Or he's in The Goonies.
In The Sopranos.
Yeah, he's Ralph in The Sopranos. I'm talking about film.
Yeah, in film. I mean,
is he Memento?
Oh, he is in Memento.
Yeah, he's a Teddy.
He gets, like, Joe Pants has got around in the 90s and early
90s. Playing creepy little weirdos.
Creepy little weirdos.
Most importantly, he's a voice actor in
Cats and Dogs.
Yes, he
Elijah Wood's second best film.
Wait, so
do you include all Lord of the Rings as one?
Yes, that's one.
Okay. Thank goodness. And you've not seen The Ice Storm.
I've not seen Ang Lee's The Ice Storm, no.
I think that'd be my ranking. Return of the King, Cats and Dogs, and Dan Fellowship.
Oh, goodness. Okay, but no, Joey Pants is really good in the movie. And the fact that he turns up in one scene, and you're like, okay, this is like a bit character, because that's why he goes so big, that he's clearly in one scene, and they want this character to make an impression. No, he's in the whole film.
He's in the whole film. He's a guy on the end of a phone, kind of losing his mind.
And he ends up in a supermarket in public, just like shouting down the phone at like a sushi restaurant or something.
I do think they shot all his scenes in one day, because he never leaves that room.
No, yeah, no. I think...
But no,
when he goes to the restaurant.
No, but he changes outfits. It's his office. It's not. Yeah. It's where he is every day. He changes his outfit in like every scene, even if that scene ostensibly is the same day.
But the thing is, all of his outfits are so fucking nuts. Like, there's always some insane shirt that he's wearing with the braces
and the cardigan.
And the cardigan. But then again, the eye travels to the comb over and the earring
and the goatee
and his weird little face. Yeah,
I love him so much.
He's great. I think he's a great addition to this film. I think all of the supporting cast in this movie, like Yaphet Kotto as the FBI agent, every time he walked into a room, the sting, like the musical sting that plays, gets louder. And the last time he does it, it's deafening. It's so big. And it's just like, yeah, I get it. He's more annoyed now. Because it's just, his frustration escalates astronomically throughout the movie.
You know the best use of Yaphet Kotto in a film? Is when you have a big guy and then you're with that guy and you think, oh, this is a big guy. Then Yaphet Kotto enters for like 10 feet of Yaphet Kotto, like a built like a brick shit house.
Yeah, he was like the Hapthor Bjornsson of his own time.
But like that's what he is in Live and Let Die. That's what he does in Alien to Harry Dean Stanton. Yeah. It's Harry Dean Stanton, tall guy, Yaphet Kotto, brick shit house.
Massive dude.
And he's doing this here, not just Robert De Niro, but to John Ashton as well. Especially to John Ashton.
John Ashton, he intimidates the fuck out of several times.
Well, he's usually surrounded by a bunch of FBI agents, all of whom like get up to his shoulders.
Again, I should establish the FBI agents, not the boys.
Not the boys.
The FBI are never the boys.
FBI should never be the boys.
Same way the British Army, never the boys.
That's absolute.
Yeah. A-Camp, all cops are not boys.
All cops are not.
I will say, exception to the rule, but they're not technically cops. The Untouchables, they're Treasury agents. I feel like you have to let the Untouchables get
tax
in with the
cops.
Boys. Tax cops against Al Capone.
We are getting off topic.
Is it time to wrap this section?
I think so. I think Midnight Run, great movie.
Yeah.
Great movie, honestly, great
pants. Anything else we can say about it would be a spoiler or some great lines, so just go watch it.
Yeah.
Availability.
So we're about to talk about cops.
We are about to talk about cops.
The Guard.
I don't think The Guard is a movie about the boys.
Mm.
No. If there were more cops, if McBride lived long enough, could it be about the boys?
I'll get on to McBride.
Okay. Midnight Run, availability. You can rent it on Amazon, Google Play, Microsoft, YouTube, Apple TV, Sky Store, and
Rakuten TV.
Which is all the proof you need that this is a good movie.
And you can buy it on all those channels. All right, let's move on to our final film of what is right now the evening. But for you, could be any time, because that's how podcasting works. Play the trailer.
The victim's a John Doe.
John Doe, is he?
We're investigating a murder and the trafficking of over $500 million worth of cocaine.
The men involved in the trafficking are highly dangerous. And if... Yes, Sergeant.
I thought only black lads are drug dealers. And Mexicans.
The Guard is a 2011 film directed by John Michael McDonagh, starring Brendan Gleeson. When Jerry Boyle, a small-town Irish cop with a crass personality, is partnered with a straight-laced FBI agent, Wendell Everett, to bust an international drug trafficking ring, they must settle their differences in order to take down a dangerous gang. Which makes this movie sound a lot more action-packed than I think it is.
It's quite action-packed by...
There's action at the end.
It also sounds like they have, like, a breakthrough at any point, but no, they just muddle along together.
Yeah, I think the most common line that Everett says throughout the movie is "fuck you, sergeant." Like that he says that with varying degrees of sort of like love and care. What did you guys think of this film?
I first watched it because we've actually been planning this episode for longer than we've planned other episodes. So I actually got around to watching it for the first time a while back when I was at home, and I watched it with my dad and my brother, and we all really enjoyed it. And then I rewatched it for this, and I really liked it both times. I think I liked it more the first time. I've got some things that I don't love about it, but I really like it, and I think it's a really solid film and such an interesting counterpoint for the obvious reasons to the Martin McDonagh movie in Bruges.
Yes, the brothers McDonagh.
Tale as old as time.
As old as time. Two brothers, both born in Ireland, raised in England.
No, both born in England.
I thought they were both born in Ireland.
No, their parents were born... Let me just double check. I'm pretty sure both born in London. Clever. John Michael McDonagh, born in London.
Oh, there we go.
And Martin McDonagh, born in Camberwell.
There we go.
And Martin McDonagh, what we haven't mentioned, is dating an English aristocrat.
Yes, he is.
Traitor.
I mean...
Hey, look,
if we start judging Irish guys by what English person they're dating, then, you know, we're going to get into all sorts of trouble. I specifically am going to get into all sorts of issues.
I'd break some of my principles if an aristocrat wanted to date me just for that.
Yeah.
I feel like once you kill Lord Mountbatten, everything's sort of open to you.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they did the thing. Much like Angela Bassett.
It's like Angela Davis did the thing.
But she didn't do the thing because she wasn't nominated for shit.
Perhaps she should have been nominated.
Angela Davis. Oh. Is she like a feminist author?
Theorist. Activist. Notable communist. Angela Davis did the thing.
She did the thing.
By
arguably.
Not being assassinated by the CIA. Well, she had to flee to Cuba for a bit.
I didn't know that. Good for her.
Good for her. She did
Good
the thing.
Are you having you want to be a terrible idea?
I'm the worst. What do you think?
Oh, something interesting. So, in Bruges...
Good, I'm glad it was interesting.
In Bruges, it's about two guys being stuck in a place. Midnight Run is about two guys going towards a very clear destination. Mikey and Nick is about two guys aimlessly going around and chasing each other. The Guard, they're meant to be going after people. Are they really?
No.
Well,
it's my favourite quotes is like, they always say that the first 24 hours counts, but in my experience, that's a load of shite. It doesn't really make a difference. And sure enough, in that 24-hour period, he finds all the things he needs to know just by going along with his day. It's a holistic experience for Jerry Boyle.
Policing's more about vibes.
In the West of Ireland, the Guard would have you believe that in the West of Ireland, policing is mostly about the vibes.
But it starts off and you think it's going to be a procedural with this like seven-esque like serial killer scene.
But then it
turns into something completely different, like at least twice.
He lays his hand on that corpse crotch, I think that's pure comedy. And he's just like play it, and he's just really freaking out McBride, who's... So, to be clear, there's a new... It sets itself up very much as sort of a classic buddy cop thing.
Like it's Training Day in Galway.
In Galway, yeah. Training Galway. And you have this sort of, like, experienced, hard-nosed cop who doesn't flinch from, like, five dead teenagers in a car and steals their LSD. Does it on the job. And then you get this sort of like bright-eyed, bushy-tailed young policeman who comes in
from the city,
from the big shitty bays, and he demeans him and insults him and dismisses and belittles him, and he just fucking dies.
Very early in the movie, this isn't really a spoiler.
No, not a spoiler at all.
But you think the two of them are going to be the buddies?
Yeah,
and Don Cheadle shows up.
Then Don Cheadle's like, no, I know this actor.
He can't die soon.
No, not at all. Yeah, I think it's a really interesting subversion of the buddy cop genre, such as it is. because it's not a buddy cop film, it's a western. And I think, again, it's two guys sort of ambling about trying to solve something, being connected to criminality by virtue of Jerry being just not a corrupt cop, because
he's not corrupt, but he is a corrupted cop.
Yeah, he's a corrupted, he's
a corrupted person who happens to be quite a decent cop.
Yeah, he's a good policeman. This is something that happens, like, the only times he ever fucks with people is when he knows more than they do. And it's like, he's not, he doesn't do any, like, he says a lot of shit. Like,
he doesn't plant drugs on people, he steals their drugs and uses them.
Yeah, it's a more pure way of being a corrupt person. And when they have the big conference all about, like, briefing them all on the drug smuggling ring, which we do have to speak about at some point.
Such a good scene.
Such a great scene. It's when he recognizes the man in his morgue that he then starts to be deliberately antagonistic. Because he's just like, you can't say anything because I already know I'm connected to this case now. Like, you have to include
me. And I also know that I will be vindicated by the end of this conversation. Yeah. So I'm going to throw out everything here for you to talk shit about me. And then, like, I will put down the ace up my sleeve that I actually know more than you.
But the great thing about that, something I love about that scene, I've watched this, to be clear, I've watched this movie 6, 7, 10 times. It's big in my family home. The bit that I love most in that scene is when the Dublin cop, who we see getting a payoff later, turns around and he calls him a fucking knacker. And all he has to say is, fuck off back to Dublin. And he loses his mind. And there's so much already built up of, like, these two people have met several times before. And he just has this way of really getting under everyone's skin with just no... And his face is so impassive. Like, Brendan Gleeson's performance in this movie, I think, is just titanically good. Like, he doesn't give a flying fuck. And it's
but at the same time, he
cares.
Yeah, that's what I was literally going to say. He cares. He still has that Brendan Gleeson clean-shaven face.
Yes, he does. Big, open Brendan Gleeson.
Big, round melon.
Big, round melon face. And I think this movie is a really good... It hits... We were talking earlier about, like, what you want from a film, and I think The Guard has everything that I look for in a film. It's funny, it's a bit sad.
It's got Don Cheadle.
It's got Don Cheadle in it. It's got Mark Strong, like, talking about philosophy. I think that this movie for me is just, it's brilliant. I think it's just excellent.
This one I really thought was quite original too. That I know we said it's not a buddy cop thing, but as far as it plays along with those tropes going forward between Don Cheadle and Brendan Gleeson, I think what's really interesting is that the more wide-eyed or at least straight-laced partner is usually, you know, the newbie or, you know, the fresh meat. But in the chain of command, Don Cheadle is his superior.
Yeah.
But Brendan Gleeson is, like, his more worldly underling.
Yeah.
And I think that's such, like, an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, I think it's a really great dynamic. And it's also, like, Don Cheadle does probably know a lot more about international drug trafficking. But, you know, I don't know what street you're buying your cocaine on, because it's not the same street I'm buying my cocaine on. Like, you, as like, oh, you didn't know that people spoke Irish in the west of Ireland, and I'm the idiot. Like, things are like, you just fucking don't understand anything, and that's fine. It's the
combination of Cheadle's institutional and international knowledge and Gleeson's very specific localized knowledge. Yeah.
Especially as usually the big cop from the city who goes into the small town to solve a crime is shown as being the outsider who actually fixes the issue with his expertise.
Which is always weird because the city cops are always way more corrupt.
Yeah, exactly.
In real life.
yeah, exactly. And he's just like, he's from bumfuck nowhere, Galway. And he's the most corrupt man in the world.
But somehow he's quite a good cop. it's a lot of fun. Can I talk briefly, and we'll get to, you know, the drugs gang.
Yes.
Which is not a fun name for a band.
No, stop.
The drugs gang. But I want to just quickly talk about the problems I mentioned earlier. And it's kind of got this thing that I don't love about a certain sort of film, and I notice it particularly with early Tarantino films, is that every character has the same knowledge and has the same, particularly like colloquial and pop cultural knowledge as the writer.
I do know what you mean, yeah.
And like, I don't mind that Mark Strong, Liam Cunningham and David Wilmot are in a car talking about Nietzsche and Bertrand Russell, but that would be fine if like one of them knew it.
Yeah.
And that was a specific quirk of that character. But it feels like, it's not that it's unrealistic even that certain classes of people wouldn't have this academic knowledge, but at a certain point it feels more like the writer trying to show us something that is really not that substantial.
Yeah, and there's the scene in Bruges where Ray Fiennes goes, "You're standing around like Robert fucking Powell," and just goes, "Who is that?"
Yes, but that's how I think that scene should go. You have to then explain it to the person who doesn't have the same cultural knowledge as the other person, because they are different characters with different sensibilities. And by and large, those characters in the drugs gang,
such as they are,
distinct and have their own personalities. But I just find it a bit grating when a screenwriter makes that choice. And it's a deliberate choice. Mm. It's not bad writing. It's just not my cup of tea.
No, I do. I understand exactly what you mean. I think that...
Also, like the 5.5, and he thinks it's a Fellini reference.
Yeah, there's a movie called 8.5. Great. But I think this film is much less guilty of that than Tarantino. I think, like, sometimes those conversations in Tarantino movies take up, like, whole... I mean, this is what... I think that's happened mostly in the car scene, and then it doesn't really happen again. But they have that sort of repartee that exists then between the three of them. They bounce off each other very well. They have a sort of an ease of conversation that is similar in that respect. But I think I do understand what you mean. But I think it more speaks to the fact that these are three men who are international drug smugglers and have spent a lot of time in these cars talking about, like, they've had to have developed some sort of, like, a lingua franca, as it were, like a base of conversation, as you do with colleagues.
I get it. I'm just saying that for, like, an establishing thing, and it's
their first scene as well.
Yeah, and it is fairly constructed, the whole thing. And, like, the fact that Boyle is a savant and can understand what Liam Cunningham's saying when he talks about, say, the occult, and he, like, has this shorthand knowledge of all these. And it's just like, I just wish there was more differentiation between the characters' intelligences.
Yeah. Yeah, I get what you mean. But I suppose at the same time, everyone always accuses Boyle of being an idiot.
Yeah. Well, you see, I don't know if you're really dumb or really motherfucking smart.
Yeah, exactly. And that being sort of like the sting at the end, not to spoil it, but that is sort of like one of the last things that's said in a flashback.
He has a little cheeky smile.
His little cheeky smile. And I think that the idea of intelligence is played with quite a lot, because even though the drugs gang do talk about philosophy, and they do talk about, you know, and he talks about the occult and stuff, they're actually fundamentally...
And they talk about psychology.
And they talk about psychology. They're fundamentally, like, you know, David Wilmot in particular, kind of a fool.
Yeah.
And Mark Strong at the end, it's kind of revealed he's just a bit of a psycho.
Yeah.
And... you know, I think they all have these kind of layers. I think it's also quite a short film.
I agree.
And, you know, it doesn't have a lot of time to go into all of that. I feel like I'm really defending this fucking
movie. No, you can. No, sorry. I also didn't mean for this to take up quite so much time. This was sort of my main reservation about the film, but of a film that I really enjoy.
Yeah.
The last thing I want to say on the matter is that the whole bit of Mark Strong saying, well, this shooter, no, it has to be like a shooter. And that goes on for way longer than Ray Fiennes just simply saying, no, mate, this is the shootout. And, like, that's all you need.
Yeah.
It could just be one line and it would have exactly the same effect.
Mm. Yeah, that's very true.
Having said that, I do think Mark Strong is wonderful in this film. I mean, and the whole cast is great, but particularly Mark Strong, a man who famously looks like a shark.
I like sharks.
Being in an aquarium, looking at the sharks, talking about how much he loves sharks, is so funny. I love Mark Strong. I also think Liam Cunningham is actually genuinely scary in this film.
It's the cheeriness. It's the offhanded way I think all of the lines are delivered by pretty much everyone except for...
McBride
and Don Cheadle and Everett. Mm. They're the only two who kind of deliver things with a level of sort of like certainty or like seriousness. Everyone else, even like the, you know, the big city boys, the cops from out of town, they all have a sort of like slight tilt to what they're saying. Like, you know, the liquidated by the mob conversation is just something that endures in my memory.
Not to bring up who knows who wrote this show, but it did remind me in a good way of Father Ted.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I don't know who wrote that show, so...
No, I think that. Famously Father Ted appeared one day on TV.
And no one wrote it.
No one wrote it.
Yeah.
And then the cameras were rolling.
No, it's incredible. It's a real slice of life.
Is there something to... And it's fine if there isn't, but it was something I was wondering that both in Midnight Run and The Guard, the most prominent FBI character is played by a black actor.
I don't know, there's something in there.
There's not something in it, but it is just interesting that the way that they choose to differentiate the federal power of the United States, either in you know, state by state, going from small town in the case of Midnight Run, or in the case of this small Irish place, is by this sort of walking symbol of multiculturalism.
I think that if they were white FBI agents, it'd be a bit harder to like them.
No, that's
because
totally
of the implication.
Well, that's what I was wondering about. Yeah. No, do you think it's a deliberate choice, or do you just think it's because Don Cheadle is possibly the best straight man working in Hollywood?
I mean, I think Don Cheadle's straight man abilities are incredible, and I think also Everett being black is so important to sort of, especially at that time. You know, you're talking 2011, you're talking middle of Obama era. You like go back to America with your Barack Obama, like shit, you know, all of that stuff that's coming through. I think that it's really important that when the guy from America shows up, he is black and he is sort of like a highly educated person.
He can't pass.
He can't pass, exactly. And it's good to have that contrast, because I don't know how much time you've spent in Ireland, particularly the west of Ireland. Not a plethora of pigmentation there.
There is a dearth of melanin.
Truly. And he stands out. And there's one, like, I really like that whole montage of him just kind of going around the place. And every time someone actually speaks to him, they want to know if he's from the behavior science unit.
Is that a Science of the Lambs reference?
It's like Science of the Lambs. It's like Criminal Minds. Yeah. Like, you know, it's that whole thing. So that's like a big export. If you know about like the FBI, it's like, oh my god,
it from films.
Yeah, and even that, then at the beginning, it's like, oh, you're hunting a serial killer. It's like all the occult themed stuff. Maybe we got a serial killer on our hands. It's like, oh, is that why he's here? No. Just drugs.
Whereas I think Yaphet Kotto fulfills a different purpose in that he is just so big.
He's scary.
And so powerful. Yeah. And the rest of the cast is what, like, he just stands out so much.
Like, if you were going to cast a white character in that role, it would have had to be Andre the Giant or something like that. We Yaphet Kotto is not like him being black. It's a film that's half in LA, half in New York. It's not the exceptional that he's black.
And Chicago.
And Chicago.
But he does stand out amongst, I don't know, Dorfler does just sort of seem particularly uncomfortable because he's being talked down by this massive guy who is also black.
Also, every time that they speak, like, Yaphet Kotto sits like punishingly close to him.
Yeah. Like, and steals his cigarettes
every single time.
Moving back to the gun. Sorry. Yeah, you were saying over dinner that you think this is Mark Strong's, did you say best? Or
I said his sexiest.
I think
it's the sexiest role, perhaps next to Syriana.
Mark Strong in this, as I was saying to you, it makes me laugh when they do the slideshow in that briefing scene and he's got this like Justin Bieber wig. And you're like, that's Mark Strong, famous bald actor.
Was born bald, lived bald, and will die bald.
Most people are born bald.
I wasn't.
That does not surprise me.
No, and I wanted to say that because Charlie's in the room.
Would it surprise you to know that I was?
No.
But I was born with a full chest of hair.
I was born with a mustache.
Yeah, I thought you were.
And an earring.
Cigarettes.
Fucking difficult to put on when you're... Then closing thoughts.
Closing thoughts about the guard. I think once again you have this nice little examination of masculinity, again going back to what I was saying in Midnight Run, where you have this man who is lonely. He has a little house that he lives on his own, clearly never had a wife, and like, you know, he even says, it's like, oh, do you have a wife, kids? I'm like, no, too busy whoring around. And it's like, you're a man, and...
which we haven't talked about the horrors.
We have the horrors. Yeah, it's, I think that he is lonely, but there's a loneliness that he's happy with. And I think possibly the best scene in the film, not funniest scene, is when he's packing up his mum's house and he says to the carer, it's like, she was a good woman, she's a proud woman, she was my mother, and he shakes her hand and he just leaves. There is something about that moment as he's packing up that feels like a man who has lost all his connections and is very truly alone in the world. And I feel you get that sense that he is coming to terms with that then when he goes on to ring Wendell later and tell him about what's going to happen. And he's like, well, go on. You do what you do best. You know best. And there's this way, again, that Brendan Gleeson has delivering lines that feels he's saying so much in such a clipped way. I just think he's a brilliant actor.
For the third time, a character who says tons of horrible things and does tons of horrible things, but you can't help but feel endeared towards
him. But you get the sense with him, unlike Colin Farrell in Bruges, that he's doing it for a reason. He's doing it to weigh someone up in the conversation. And it doesn't make what he's saying better, but there is method in the...
In the nonsense.
Exactly. Not madness. But...
No, it's not madness, because he's not mad. He's not cracked at all. He's just someone who likes to poke people.
Yeah, because it's also a good indicator of who they are when they're poked.
Yeah.
And he's very good at it.
Yeah. Very good
at it. Okay, you can stream this on Netflix and Studio Canal. You can rent it on Rakuten TV. Oi, oi. YouTube.
Is that 4 for 4?
No, it is 4.
That's 4 for 4.
That's 4 for 4, baby.
You can rent this on Amazon, Google Play, Microsoft, YouTube, Rakuten TV, Apple TV, Sky Store, and BFI Player. And you can buy it on all those channels except for BFI Player and Sky Store. All right, so, Fionn, as you know, as a listener of the podcast, that we'd like to ask people, if in Bruges is the main course, which of our three alternates is dessert?
It's not Mikey and Nikki. I couldn't watch Mikey and Nikki immediately after watching...
Instead, you watched it immediately before.
Yes, I watched it beforehand, yes.
I think Mikey and Nikki is the coffee.
Yeah, Mikey and Nikki is sort of like the cigar you had earlier in the day that kind of
ruins the meal.
It's repeating on you. I would say that the desserts for this film, I would pick The Guard. I think these films go well together. I think that they are a nice sort of, they're not too similar. I think Midnight Run would be too similar to it in terms of like what you're getting from it. I think that The Guard is short, funny, sweet, hits a similar thing, but not the exact same.
Midnight Run and The Guard are two monkey hookers. Mikey and Nikki is a racist dwarf.
Yeah, I see it.
Yeah. The presence of Joe Pantoliano makes your film a manky hooker.
Christ. I think that discounting Mikey and Nikki for the reasons you guys have said...
There's an eye.
Of the two, I think I like Midnight Run more. However, I think Midnight Run is a very, very good version of a fairly common sort of film. I think that the fact that The Guard is quite an original way of telling what at first seems like a familiar story, I think that makes me appreciate it more than Midnight Run, even if I enjoy watching Midnight Run more and I have more problems with The Guard than I do with Midnight Run.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. It's just different.
Hmm.
It's very different.
They are different films.
Famously.
And I do think that on as much of an objective level as you can measure it, Mikey and Nikki is probably the most interesting of the four, the most like unique and competently made of the four. For its interaction between its uniqueness and its quality, I just think that when you phrase the question as what's dessert,
people tend to take it very literally.
Yeah, and Mikey and Nikki gives me more of the sensation that I get from watching Safety Brothers films than what I get from watching.
Well, we said in our graduate episode, The Heartbreak Kid is a big influence on Uncut Gems, which I find crazy because, to me, Mikey and Nikki is so much more similar to Uncut Gems.
Yes. I mean, yeah, it's that same sort of, oh, don't do that. Why are you doing that? Ugh, stop it.
But at the same time, I think The Heartbreak Kid is so stressful as well, in a very different way.
In The Heartbreak Kid, you can laugh the stress out. In Mikey and Nikki, you're just left with a lot
you're
of
you're stewing with these horrible men. You can't even deal with the fact that Jeannie Boleyn got out okay.
I'm just barricading myself into my flat with my furniture.
All right. As always, our producer was Jade Corbett. Our art was done by Molecule. If you want to follow us on social media, it's on @BCUWatchPod on Twitter, @BCUWatchPodcast on Instagram. Fionn, thank you so much for coming. Do you have anything you want to plug?
Listen to Demonology, a Six Planes game podcast. It's good, and I'm on that.
And so are friends of the pod, Alex Wilcox and Siobhan Brown.
Yes.
Thank you very much, Francesca.
Thank you, Charlie.
And thank you for listening.